The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's special hour-long presentation features a conversation with former Congressman Lee Hamilton and Senator Richard Lugar.
The origin of the word Hoosier has eluded historians. Those who live outside our state are often confounded by its meaning. To us in this room, the word Hoosier has a clear meaning. Hoosier is a description of all of us who call Indiana our home. But there is a richer, deeper meaning of the word Hoosier. Hoosier is an aspiration. Hoosier encompasses a set of values and ideals, a model for a person of Indiana. Hoosier reflects all that we hope we can and should be as a person, a neighbor, and a citizen of our state. There are perhaps no two persons who more perfectly embody the highest meaning of Hoosier than our speakers today, Senator Richard G. Lugar and Congressman Lee Hamilton. Senator Lugar and Congressman Hamilton are persons of enormous integrity, intelligence, compassion, empathy, inclusion, diligence, civility, and humility. Both have selflessly dedicated their entire professional lives to the service of our state, our nation, and the world. Both have improved the lives of countless people throughout the globe. Senator Lugar and Congressman Hamilton are what we can only hope our own daughters and sons grow up to be. We are particularly reminded that today, primary day in Indiana, Senator Lugar and Congressman Hamilton's form of leadership is in more demand than ever. We are so grateful that they're willing to join us today to offer their insights on the state of our nation and the world with an underlying theme of civility. Will you please welcome me in joining two model Hoosiers, Senator Richard G. Lugar and Congressman Hamilton. From the founding of our country, there has been great debate about the role the United States should play in the world. Currently, Donald Trump and Senator Sanders are advocating a more limited role than has been the case since World War II. What should be the United States' role in the world, and where does our fight against ISIS and terrorism fit in our foreign policy priorities?
Well, Matt, delighted to be here, especially pleased, of course, to be here with Senator Lugar. He and I have done this kind of thing before, but never before such an elite audience as we have here. Delighted to be here with all of you. I believe in a very robust, strong leadership role for the United States in the world. I don't want to see the United States retreat from leadership. I know of my own experience how often other countries, foreign ministers, prime ministers turn to the United States for leadership, and I want us to try to fill that role. I want American foreign policy to be perceived as the United States being a benign power. When a disaster strikes, when a virus hits, when you have refugees, I want the United States to be in the forefront of responding on a humanitarian basis to meet the needs of these people. Secondly, I want our diplomats, and we have very skillful diplomats, to be known throughout the world as people who try to reduce tension, solve conflicts, and keep things running as smoothly as possible. I want the United States to be leading to the establishment of democratic institutions around the world, freedom and justice for all. With regard to the toughest question in American foreign policy, which is always military intervention. I want military intervention to be not the first resort, but the last resort. I've become very skeptical of military power after Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. You always have to have military power. It's a very important part of the foreign policy. But I think we've seen, whereas it can accomplish a number of things, bring stability, control areas, there are political and economic problems that underlie these conflicts where there are limitations to what the military can do. I want the United States to get our own political and economic house in order. We convened a bunch of national security experts at Bloomington the other day from all over the country, and they said the number one foreign policy problem is our domestic dysfunction. So the example that the United States gives in our political and economic life is a powerful foreign policy tool. Now, you mentioned ISIS and terrorism. That's an urgent threat. It's a serious threat. And it has to be met with a variety of tools, economic, political, military, a very, very tough challenge for us. But in many ways, in my view, the peace and prosperity of the world will depend more on our relationship, for example, with China, than it will what happens with regard to ISIS. I don't want to downplay the threat from ISIS. But getting the relationship right between the United States and China is the key. That's the key bilateral relationship, and is going to determine what kind of a world you and your children, grandchildren have. Finally, let me just say, and I don't mean to take too long, but I have come to the view that the United States cannot fix every problem in the world, that there are limitations to our resources. And in an area like the Middle East, which I have seen every president since Lyndon Johnson become swept up in the vortex of the Middle East, in that kind of an area, we will not define the problem. We will not solve the problem by ourselves. We have to have help. And I've come to the view that we must insist upon performance by the political leaders in the region, and if we don't get it, we can't solve the problem. That's a start. Okay.
Senator Lugar.
Well, thank you very much, Matt, and I join Lee in thanking all of you for coming together today to think with us, and it's an honor to be with Lee and to each one of you. I have found myself in agreement with what my colleague has already mentioned, but let me add a few more thoughts about America's role in the world. First of all, I would suggest that we ought to strengthen our NATO alliance. One of the great features in our world has been about 50 years of peace in Europe. That has been a unique period for Europe, given the history of the countries there. Largely came about because of the North Atlantic Alliance aspect, the Canada, United States experience with NATO. NATO sometimes seems to be faltering in terms of military budgets and their dedication to each other, and we have an obligation to be helpful in making certain that that alliance is strong for their sake and for ours. And likewise, I would suggest that we need to spend more time thinking about our relationship with allies in Asia, with the ASEAN organization, or APEC. We have very strong ties with Japan, with South Korea, with Australia, and an increasing number of countries in Asia. The so-called pivot to Asia is not really quite complete and sometimes not well defined or understood. But it's very important to have these friends all over Asia, with growing countries and growing aspirations. This means that we need to have a fleet capacity, the United States Navy that really is able to cover the oceans, not just the Mediterranean and some of the difficult straits, but likewise the Pacific area, the Atlantic, maybe the Arctic in due course as melting continues. I mention that because the United States Navy is the basis on which world trade, free trade among the nations, really can continue. That prospers other nations in addition to our own, but is very, very important in terms of world understanding and world progress. Then I would mention also a subject that is bound to be controversial just at the sake of it. But we are now working internationally with countries thinking about the so-called global warming, thinking about the control of CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, I appreciate many feel that the scientific community has not made enough of a case to be convincing, but I'm one who has been convinced, and I believe that this is an extraordinary serious problem. It cannot be solved by the United States alone. As a matter of fact, our contribution may be fairly small. Very important that China, India, various other countries with large population, a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, be very much a part of this. And we're going to have to work very hard to try to bring about that international understanding. I would mention also the World Health Organization. This is an international way in which we try to track plagues and particular situations that may be injurious to us before they get to us. We help a lot of other people, bring about cures, learn the science of how we would treat people in the United States who might be afflicted. But increasingly, we are seeing these world health situations. And finally, two things that are difficult, to say the least, in terms of foreign policy, but a part of this. One is cybersecurity. It could be that the next severe attack upon the United States would not be a nuclear missile or certainly a conventional warfare business, but those who are able to shut down our communication system, our banking system in various areas, or our hospital systems, or what have you, from afar, without really having any personal engagement in this country. Our understanding of cybersecurity is not in its infancy, but at the same time does not really lead to a great feeling of security on the part of many Americans who are in institutions who understand, really, the vulnerability. And finally, I would point out that we have probably 24 nations on Earth that still have remnants of weapons of mass destruction. Two of them are the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and the United States. This is still fairly obvious, with about 1,500 nuclear warheads still in the possession of both countries, still in a firing range, really. One of the things that was awesome for me when I went down into a silo in Siberia one time, saw the pictures of cities on the wall where the guards were, came back to see whether Indianapolis might be one of the cities. I found it certainly was. Every city of any size in the United States, every military installation was targeted by the almost 10,000 nuclear warheads that were much more devastating than Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Any one or two of those could have pretty well flattened this entire city. All the time I was mayor, I had no idea we were under the gun to that extent. We talked about 40 years of mutually assured destruction, but this brought a reality. We still have those problems with the Russians, but we also have the problem that 22 other nations have remnants, sometimes under military control, sometimes less than that. The Nuclear Threat Initiative Group that my partner Sam Nunn founded, and I'm a board member, has made a catalog now of where all this material is and precisely what the condition of it is. And this is very important to follow through on, to try to rid as much of the world as possible of the potential for somebody in the terrorism business to come in, scoop it up, and make a dirty bomb and make a hell out of some city of the United States of America. So these are some of my thoughts about our involvement.
Thank you.
Turning a little bit closer to home, a common theme among many is that our country has become increasingly divided politically, racially, economically, and religiously. To what degree do you think this notion is a reality, and what are its causes and implications for our country? Mm-hmm. Perhaps, Senator Lew, you can start.
Well, we, of course, are here, as you pointed out, in a primary day in Indiana. All over the country, people are writing about us and about the campaign that's been waged by candidates in our state and what they've had to say about each other and about life in general. It's apparent that each of these divisions that you've mentioned is important to some persons, some to the point of being very angry, being exasperated. I think the anger factor may have been overstated, but it's obviously there if you have candidates that appeal to it. And without naming any particular candidate, if you have a situation in which for you some aspects of life are very disturbing. You're worried about your job or your income, worried about your children's future, feel that life has been unfair in terms of income division in the country, feel that somehow or other your religious ideas are not respected. And somebody comes along and says, I'm going to sock it to them. You like that idea. Somebody might repair all of this in some fashion of that variety, which is, of course, not going to happen in this world, but at the same time, emotionally is satisfying. I don't want to overemphasize the division idea. I think those divisions have always been there. Politically, we have Republicans and Democrats and sometimes third parties. Sometimes we have groups that always have been unhappy with each other on religious basis or various other social ties. This may be the nature of the life that we live, and maybe as constructive citizens, we try to overcome those barriers. I hope that many of us in this room will hope to overcome them. But at the same time, it's not a point that I would overemphasize, even though it very clearly is a current event.
Well, I'm not a declinist. I don't think America is going to the dogs. I think in many ways the best years are ahead of us. And I flat out don't agree with politicians who are spreading a lot of gloom and doom about the country. I'm optimistic about the future of the country and its people. I have a lot of more confidence in our system of representative democracy than I think most of these people probably have. I believe the fundamentals of our system are sound, are good. We are in a challenging time, without any doubt. There are stresses on that system, and you have to work very hard to make it work. But that's our job. When I went to high school in Evansville, my total world was basketball, and I thought the epitome of achievement was to win the state high school basketball championship, which I never did. I can tell you the story about that if you're interested. I suspect you're not. The point is that we had at that time 130 million people in the country. Today, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's around 320 million. So in the working lifetime for Dick and me, and many of you, the country has far more than doubled in size and become much, much more diversified. So that when I walk out of a hotel in Miami, Florida, and ask to get a paper, I put 50 cents in the slot, it says the Miami Herald, and I pull out the paper, I can't read a word of it. And I turned to a fellow on the, it's all in Spanish, and I turned to a fellow on the street and say, where do I get an English language newspaper? And he said, we don't have any here, you got to walk a half mile down the street. Now, I'm not talking about Mexico City, I'm talking about Miami, Florida. This country is changing. It's got a lot of people very uneasy, uncomfortable, because it's not quite like it used to be. So immigration becomes a big issue. I believe the centrifugal forces in the country today are quite strong. And I am impressed with how many former presidents and high leaders of our country, when they give their valedictory, express themselves on the unity of the country and how important it is to maintain that unity. In other words, from their posture, from their position, they see the centrifugal forces that are at work. You mentioned race, class, religion, ethnic, and whatever the divisions are. A couple of observations on a personal level. I think it's very important, I'm talking to myself here as much as to you, it's very important that we try to get outside our comfort zone, that we have in our lives an effort to mingle and mix with groups that are very different from us. We've got to push the boundaries on a personal basis. All of us have to do that, because we tend to get segregated, but it does create a distortion in your view of the country. The second thing I'd say is, so that's a personal thing. The second thing is that there are a lot of institutions today which formerly played a role in bringing us together, compromising our differences, that are weakened and not as strong as they used to be. I think there are several examples, but take the political party, for example. The political parties, Republicans and Democrats, for many years have played a very important role in building a consensus within the party of a disparate points of view. In other words, they played a bringing together role. Those political parties have now been weakened, and that's true of other organizations and institutions in the country. So we have to think in terms of mechanisms and institutions that bring us together as a people. And I think the last comment I'd make here is that economic growth will solve a lot of these problems. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And because it'll remove some of the hard edges and the tensions in our society today. A lot of the unease in the country today, I think, is economic, and the wages have stagnated for so many Americans and other aspects of it. So I think solid economic growth will solve a lot of these division problems. I think it's a challenge. But I want to end as I began. We have a great country. It's a magnificent country. And it's enabled all of us to live good lives. But we still need to make sure that the goodness of the country, the prosperity of the country, the good aspects of the country are spread to a larger group of people.
Thank you. What are your insights about how Congress is functioning? And what needs to change for Congress to function better?
How long do you have? Should I answer first?
Please. Yeah.
I think every one of us are disappointed in many ways, for good reasons, in the performance of the Congress. It cedes way too much power to the president, even though they don't like the president. They give the president total authority to run a war. It's too deferential. It cedes too much economic power to the Fed. When I was first in the Congress, there would not be more than one American in 1,000 who could name the chairman of the Fed. Today, you can hardly read the business papers, business sections of the paper, without seeing Janet Yellen's name. What's happened? What's happened is that the Congress and the President have given up on fiscal authority, the taxing and spending power, and the Fed has stepped in, the monetary power side, supply of money, so that they have ceded power to the Fed. They've ceded power to the regulatory agencies. They complain about the regulatory agencies constantly. Every time I pick up a paper, they're complaining about them. That's okay. I complain about them too. But they have the power of the purse. And they can use that power, if they want to direct the regulatory agencies, and they don't do it. So we find a lot of problems. There's endless pandering in the political system today. Excessive partisanship. Lack of oversight. One of the key roles of the Congress is to oversee the executive branch. It just has almost quit with regard to that. And a failure to address all kinds of problems. Every TV commercial I see, the candidate says, I'm for tax reform. Everybody's for tax reform. It never happens, does it? All kinds of things they're not doing that they should be doing. So Congress is not today a co-equal branch of government by any definition. It's not even close. Power has been dispersed. And one of the amazing things to me, it doesn't care. Every group that you belong to, I'd be willing to bet, every single group sits around and thinks about how to do the job you're supposed to do better. Right? Except the United States Congress. When Dick and I were in the Congress, we always had a reform effort going. Didn't always make a lot of progress, but we were at least trying. They don't do it anymore. So what needs to be done? Well, I've spoken too long already, but let me tick off two or three things very quickly. Dick, I hope you'll speak on the question of nominations being held up. Will you say a word about that? Or if you won't, I'll say it for you. I don't know. take the schedule. Legislators don't work hard enough at legislating. Members of Congress work very hard, but not at legislating. Legislating is very tough business. Building a consensus behind a solution to a problem in a country as big and complicated and diverse as ours is very hard work. And it takes time and patience and perseverance. You cannot do it on a Tuesday to Thursday schedule. You cannot do it. And they are not doing it because that's kind of a schedule they're on. Campaign finance reform, more competitive seats, strengthening the middle, the extremes. Liberals in the Democratic Party, conservatives in the Republican Party have too much clout. The big political question is what's happened to the middle, what's happened to the moderate center. I want to see the deal makers come back. As Lyndon Johnson, I went to Congress when he was the president. Lyndon Johnson was interested in one thing. What do I have to do to get your vote? You want a bridge built? I'll build the bridge. You want to meet the Pope? I'll send you to Rome. And on and on. Now look, that may make you uneasy, but we need members of Congress who are deal makers, who bring people together, who find out the commonalities and the differences, who decide what can be done and what cannot be done. That's legislative skill. We need people to compromise and negotiate. I know that it's easy to get up and give a speech and an ideological speech. I know it's easy because I've done it. But it's a formula for gridlock. It's a formula for not getting anything done. And we've got a country to make work.
Thank you. Senator Lugar?
One of the strong points about this country is that we have a great constitution that works despite all the deficiencies that we're discussing today about the Congress. I'm sympathetic, as a matter of fact, with the president making decisions because the Congress does not. The fact is, decisions need to be made, and they're being made. I'm sympathetic with Janet Yellen, for that matter, and the Fed. If, as Lee says, this is the deficiency of the Congress, that's too bad, but the fact is that we, thank goodness, have a system in which we're able to move ahead. Ideally, the checks and balances, the strength of the Congress, would be very important to improve, and I'm very hopeful we will make headway with that. But let me just give these factors. Currently, as many have pointed out, the House of Representatives comes from so-called gerrymandering. That is, after each census, the legislators in a state draw new lines. If possible, if you're a Republican in the legislature, you might favor drawing lines that make seats safe, in quotes, for Republican candidates. In other words, you put all the Democrats into one district or some other place so that there is not going to be a status from that state that reflects precisely the political balance, but as a matter of fact, reflects really the legislature at that point and the gerrymandering every 10 years. Now, with this being the case, the problem then becomes for most members of the House of Representatives in particular, to some extent the Senate, how do you survive in this situation? Because essentially, if you are in a safe Republican seat or a safe Democratic seat, the real race is going to be the primary. It's going to be today, for example, not the general election. This means that, by and large, there'll be a competition for the... it means essentially that the person who is the most extreme in the district, either on the right or the left, is the most likely winner. Because that is going to be the case in the general election, being a safe seat. This has led, over the course of time, to more and more members, both Republican and Democrat, being extreme persons. Extreme in the sense of my way or the highway, that I have really a doctrinal basis for being as I am. But even more so, I have a sense of survival, because the fact is that now, given the Supreme Court decision with regard to campaign finance, there is unlimited money available in America, and it comes in to various primaries to enforce those decisions. So this is a situation in which it's not just the Republican and Democratic parties, but it's a whole host of interest groups that have their own scorecards that rate each member on the basis of whether that member votes in favor of their policies or not. And they're prepared to back that up by spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even in the case of some seats in the House of Representatives, $2 or $3 million in a single seat, without regard to whether they're Republican or Democratic, because they're in favor of a specific agenda. This means more and more that members have a sense of survival. That is, they are not in a position to go into a conference committee, as Lee and I used to, and we would see a different House bill on foreign policy, a different Senate bill, and Lee was often the leader on the Democratic side from time to time. I was chair on the Republican side, and we would find ways in which we might make progress by having a compromise that would go back to the two houses. And sometimes, because of the respect that they had for us or for others on the conference committee, both houses would vote it and the president would sign it. This was a fairly conventional way of dealing with life in the times. Now, currently, there are very, very few conference committees. As a matter of fact, as Lee pointed out, fewer and fewer hearings, fewer and fewer pieces of legislation. Simply because the risk that some members see in their votes and in getting involved in these disputes means that they're very likely to lose their seats, and they want to retain those. I don't know that I have a solution for this, aside from a new Supreme Court decision on political money, or likewise, a reform such as California's, in which essentially, in the primary day, anybody can vote, and the two candidates to get the most votes get run in the general election. It could be two Democrats running against each other, two Republicans, or what have you. But in that way, you have the right, left, and the center who are going to be influential in the primary and the general election. Other states have had legislative thoughts. Arizona, I believe, tried to discuss this and they couldn't make it across the finish line. There's their strong vested interest in keeping things as they are. But reform could occur. And when it does, Congress will be reformed. Congress will become more active again. I hope that will happen soon. I would just say, in the meanwhile, it is not an easy time for members from this state or any other state, and as we started out with, but thank goodness the decisions are made. So I applaud those that are making the decisions and really want to critique them, not all the members of Congress who are huddled trying to save their seats.
Thank you. Again, I would encourage you, if you have a question, you can write it on a card and our staff will come around and pick them up, or you can tweet those questions. But if not, I'll keep asking questions. Senator Lugar, you had a reputation of working in a bipartisan manner on judicial nominations. Can you comment on the confirmation process of federal judges and specifically the president's nominees to the United States Supreme Court?
Yes, if I were in the Senate currently, I would be in favor of having a hearing for the new nominee for the Supreme Court and having a confirmation vote during this Congress, not in the next one. In answer to Lee's question earlier on, I would favor bringing to the fore through proper hearings and vote on the Senate floor at least, I think, as many as 15 ambassadorial nominees that are still waiting. And we just finally saw a confirmation of an ambassador to Mexico after many, many months of having no one in the embassy there representing our country. The number of people, as a matter of fact, in judicial posts all over the country that are waiting confirmation means that a stack up of cases means justice delayed, justice denied in courts all over the United States. And that's the case for, of course, many people in the administration itself. The president can nominate people as assistant secretaries of state or interior or whatever, but unless they're confirmed by the Senate, they're not in a position to act, and the administration is not in a position to act.
Thank you. I have a stack of questions here, and there is a theme among several of them on the notion that the primary process, today's primary day, that some, particularly Mr. Trump and Senator Sanders, have said that the system is rigged. Do either of you believe that the system with its superdelegates and control of the parties is rigged, or is it a good system?
No, I don't believe that at all. As a matter of fact, I think that the rules have been fairly well set forward. I appreciate that Mr. Trump is essentially criticizing what he believes are attempts by his opponents to talk to the superdelegates or to talk to other delegates who are not committed by the primaries to try to get their votes so that if things do get to a second ballot, the Republican convention, for example, that they'll be in a position to be supportive of somebody else. But it appears to me that the rules of the game have been set forward, and the people are playing by the rules of the game, and the idea of a rigged situation, really in this case, is simply an intramural fight in the Republican Party.
Well, I don't believe it's rigged either. I think it's complicated. Different rules for different states, but I don't think it's rigged. I personally don't think in my party we should have what do they call them, the delegates?
Superdelegates.
Superdelegates. In other words, I'd like to see the delegates elected. I say that even though I was one.
But a very responsible years, one.
But, well, in general, my bias is towards a more open system and primaries and the like, but I want to say this in addition to what Dick has said, that with all of the complexities of the system and the difficulties of navigating it, and it's a formidable challenge for a candidate, I think the system has served us reasonably well. We've had good people become president of the United States, and we can all find fault with any candidate, of course, and we may have our preferences somewhere else, but by and large, the system has served us reasonably well.
A couple questions on this theme, which is how would you incentivize citizens to become more engaged in government?
Well, I think the question, the premise of the question is a very good one. The problem that I suggested, I think, in my remarks in politics today is what's happened to the center. And I think most Americans are in the center. You probably see the independents now are the largest segment of the voting population. even people who identify as Democrats or Republicans often wander from the fold, so they have a streak of independence about them as well. I think we have to put a lot more emphasis in our educational system on civic education. I was talking to some of our educators here a moment ago. There is enormous emphasis in education today on training people for jobs. And we understand the importance of that and the need for it. But we cannot overlook the necessity of civic education and the importance of teaching our young people, as well as the old people, how to be good citizens. So education, obviously, is a part of it. Incentivize suggests to me that the word is used in the question, should there be a monetary incentive of some kind? I'm not sure that I'd say that ought to be the case. I voted to give 18-year-olds the vote, and I've had a lot of doubt about it. I'm very disappointed in the performance of young people in voting. And the argument at the time was, if you can fight in Vietnam, you can vote. Well, that's a powerful argument that swept the country in a matter of months, weeks, and the amendment was adopted. But the fact of the matter is the qualifications for voting and the qualifications for fighting are different. But that's not going to change, so we have to find ways and means of encouraging people to vote, and that has to start early. And people have to understand the importance of that vote and how critical it is, because if they don't vote, what Dick was explaining a moment ago is exactly right. What you do, in effect, is you strengthen the extremes in the country and make the country more difficult to govern.
Now, let me pick up a slice of the question of interest in politics. I had a wonderful roundtable discussion with about 25 students from a university in Indiana recently. These were all students who came because they were interested in politics and they wanted to talk about practical politics. It was obviously a group that would appear to be young leaders who really have a future in all of this. We discussed this for a while. And just out of curiosity, I said, how many of you are prepared to run for political office at some point in your careers? Put yourself on the line. Well, I think maybe six or seven raised their hands. Now, the president of the university was sitting there, and she was appalled by this response. So we talked some more about it. But it's not unusual. Many people in communities throughout Indiana suggest that in their cities or their counties or whatever the jurisdiction is, there are very talented people who can make a great contribution to public life, to public policy, to better governance, the infrastructure of the city or town, all the rest of it. But for some reason, they are not candidates for office. They're distinguished attorneys, they're distinguished doctors, clergymen. They're doing wonderful things in the community. But the fact of life is to be a candidate for public office is to expose not only yourself, but your spouse, your children, your family, particularly in these days of social media, an enormous amount of rumor and innuendo and criticism and so forth. And likewise, spend a great deal of time raising political money, asking people for money to be able to further your campaign. This is not a pleasant prospect. Many marriages are difficult enough without having those sorts of pressures. And as a matter of fact, this leads many persons to say, I'm prepared to help somebody else. I may make a contribution to a campaign. I would like to endorse somebody, but not me on the ballot. And we're going to have to really face this problem in order to enlist the most talented citizens in our state and in our country to not only do their duty, but likewise to enjoy doing the duty, to see the excitement that both Lee and I enjoyed, and because we had the privilege.
One of the things you have to do is to remove the barriers between the voter and the voting booth. Very simple things can help, not solve the problem, but they can help. We close the voting in Indiana at 6 p.m. I could never understand that. Very hard for a lot of people to get to the polls by 6 p.m. Now let's be blunt about this. There are a lot of people who don't want to extend the vote, and they want to put barriers up between the voter and the voting booth. I'm opposed to that myself, but it's a very common thing. I knew a lot of older people who did not like to approach the precinct. They were intimidated by it because there are a lot of politicians out there shaking hands and a lot of signs and a lot of hoopla. And they were just intimidated from voting because of the noise around the precinct. So some states have done away with that. So I would come down on the side of saying you ought to try to remove as many barriers as you can from between the voter and the voting booth. And that can be a controversial matter. But I think that's the beginning, one of the beginning points here. To incentivize the voter.
Sadly, this has to be our last question because of time. But I'd like to ask each of you, tell us the most important thing we ought to hear today.
Do what?
The most important thing that all of us should hear from you today.
Should hear?
From you, right. What would you like to leave us with?
Thank you.
Almost inevitable.
Well, the thought that I would leave you with is that I really think we have a marvelous system, but it's very hard to make it work. And you have to keep working at it to make it work. So all of us as citizens have to accept our responsibilities to do what we can to vote, to be an informed voter, to work with like-minded people and all the rest of it that you hear. But the most important thing is, as citizens, to see if you can make your corner of the world a little better. And you hear a lot about cynicism and skepticism of the system today, and there are many good reasons for it. One of the reasons people don't vote is because they don't like politicians, and they have good reason to be disappointed there often. But I think you don't find people cynical or even highly skeptical who are engaged heavily in trying to make the system work. The best medicine for cynicism is involvement. And so I just encourage, look, my guess is all of these people are actively involved as citizens. And if they're not, they will be after they hear this sermon. But that's, you know, citizenship is an enormously important responsibility. And all of us have to take it very, very seriously. And if we don't, the country won't work.
Senator Lugar.
I would make this comment on a day in which the United States of America, maybe many countries around the world, are looking at Indiana, at all of us, that although many political analysts will describe in their commentary about our elections today here, that there was great division in the party, that one party or another was foundering and might split and fail, and that somehow or other the worst of political debates abounded and all the rest of it. The great fact of the matter is, looking at it objectively, if you could, from Mars down here in the United States, this is the greatest country in the world. It is the greatest country on the basis of certainly economics. We're at a time in which so many countries throughout the world are failing. I noted this morning, as I always check to see how the markets are doing, that the stock market wasn't doing so well in the United States because the fault was that China had a very bad day. And that, and China keeps having these bad days, which are very unfortunate for our markets. But then our markets are resilient enough. They accept the fact that China has had a bad day, or India, or that Greece is once again approaching bankruptcy, if not Puerto Rico, or around the globe. And the fact is that we have the strongest economy. We have the strongest military. We talked earlier about our fleet manning all the seas, providing really the possibility for worldwide trade and tourism. Sometimes in this political campaign in the United States and here in Indiana, trade has been rejected. People are against new treaties with the Europeans, even though that would strengthen, I believe, NATO and strengthen us in terms of job creation as opposed to the other way around. Ditto for the TPP treaty with Asia. Tremendous situation. The Chinese are offering an alternative treaty, the one that we've gotten together with the Japanese and the Koreans and the Australians is not accepted. In other words, as opposed to a time of pessimism and calling everybody out, there is a time to celebrate America, a time to celebrate really the strengths that we have even with all of our faults. And I think that's an important theme for today's meeting and to carry away even as we await the primary results.
Thank you. We are very grateful to both Senator Lugar and Congressman Hamilton for this wonderful discussion today. Thanks all of you for joining us today and for this entire season. Today's conversation will be rebroadcast on WFYI on June 11, and we look forward to seeing you back here for the next season. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to the Economic Club of Indiana. This episode concludes the 2015-2016 season. You can find more information and presentations at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.